Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, and I'm your host today. Before I get to our speaker, I'd like to go through a few small points. First of all, everybody, please turn off your mobiles now. If we all pull them out at the same time, or electronic devices, everybody checks. Nobody should be shy about doing so. But it really disrupts an event if we have people beeping and sounding off during the event. Next, I'd like to tell you about our upcoming events, including I'd like to announce two prominent speakers who have just finally been confirmed in the past couple hours, so you will not have seen them yet in your email. We have a quiet week next week because of the holiday. And then week after next, we have an unusually busy schedule. You'll be getting your email shortly, but we have the Deputy Prime Minister of New Zealand coming on Monday, October 5th. He seems to run half of New Zealand. He's not only Deputy Prime Minister, this is Bill English, but also the Finance Minister and the Minister of Infrastructure. Maybe they don't have enough ministers. He wears three hats. The day after that, we have Tom Curley, a name many of you probably know. He used to run USA Today. Now he is the CEO of Associated Press, the global news service. And he's in the leader of trying to figure out what are the roles of news services, how does he compete with Michael Bloomberg and so forth. He'll be our lunch speaker on Tuesday, October 6th. On Wednesday, October 7th, we have a dinner. It'll be a screening of Cambodia Dreams, which is a short movie about some of the very horrible experiences that some families have had in Cambodia over the past 30 years. And that will also include a discussion by the director, Stanley Harper, of what went into that video. Finally, then, I'd like to announce another event that you won't have gotten, you'll get the flyers for later this afternoon, but it's been confirmed, and that'll be for Thursday, week after next, as a lunch speaker. And that will be Terry Duffy, a name probably many of you recognize, one of the leaders of American finance. He is the chairman of CME Group, which is what runs most of the commodities and derivatives exchanges in the United States. So they are the parent of the NYMEX, the Chicago Board of Trade, the Chicago Commodities Exchange, and so forth. And they're the world's largest derivatives marketplace. So we'll have Terry Duffy as the chairman of CME on Thursday lunch on the 9th. With that, I'd like to introduce one of the best-known academic speakers whom we've had the pleasure to host this year on China, Martin Jacques, a name many of you know. Hope many of you have already had a chance to take a look at his book. If you haven't gotten it already, maybe you might want to get it afterwards. Those of us here in Hong Kong are already looking at what does Chinese rule or increasing Chinese rule already mean, but as the West starts to pay attention to what it means across an ever-broadening sphere of the world, Martin Jacques's been one of the most articulate voices on that. I'd like to introduce him today. Here he is.
Thank you very much, Keith, and good afternoon. The last time I was in the FCC was for the launch of the campaign for anti-racist legislation in Hong Kong in memory of my wife. And I'm very pleased that finally, a year last July, this was crowned with success and a legislation was introduced. The only other thing I want to say, apart from saying it's very nice to see some familiar faces in the audience, is to thank Christine Lowe, who is an old friend of mine. I met her originally in 1994, but she doesn't remember this. And then, in a way, our lives became entwined by the tragedy of my wife, and Christine's been a very good friend ever since, and she's organized, with her excellent organization, Civic Exchange, the program for me in Hong Kong. So I'd like to thank Christine very much. Okay, straight to business. In 1973, two-thirds of the world's GDP was accounted for by the developed world, and only a third by the developing world. Today, it's round about half. In other words, we're witnessing what is, by historical standards, an extraordinary shift in the center, in the economic center of gravity. These figures, where are we? These figures here, which are Goldman Sachs figures, but there's figures from all sorts of people that basically go along these same lines. And you'll see that by 2025, the Chinese economy will be almost the same size as the American economy. Even more dramatically, although of course more speculatively because it's further into the future, by 2050, you'll see a very different picture altogether. The Chinese economy almost twice the size of the American economy. The Indian economy almost the same size as the American economy. And making up the top 10, you'll see Mexico, Indonesia, Brazil, and those old stalwarts of the initial industrialization in the world, Britain and the United and Germany, just squeaking into the top 10. Okay, so we're witnessing a profound shift in the global, in the economic global system. But it's more than that. It's more than that. This has been seen primarily, almost exclusively, in fact, in economic terms. And the underlying assumption, I think, that's being made is that somehow modernization is a process like climbing on the escalator. And we're all heading for the same destination, and the same destination is a Western-style society. So the political and cultural effects are not interesting because they're not important because they are marginal. I think this is quite wrong. This is wrong-headed thinking. This is wrong-headed thinking. We are actually, since the middle of the 20th century, with the rise of the initial Asian tigers, witnessing for the first time, apart from Japan, apart from the exception of Japan, the modernization of a range of non-Western societies. And the modernities, and you've only got to look at Japan to seek confirmation of this, the modernities that they will develop and acquire will be very distinctive. They will overlap in all sorts of ways for the West, that is already very evident. But they will not be simply mimics of the West. We are moving into a world of multiple modernities, or as I argue in the first part of the book, this is the era of contested modernity. This is a completely new era. We've not experienced this kind of era before. And I think what will clinch this point in the mind of everyone is the rise of China. China, with its extremely distinctive history, its vastness, its culture, will be different. It will not be a clone of Western modernity. It will have a very distinctive Chinese modernity. Now, what I want to do today, in the short time I have available, is to give four key characteristics of China which I think will profoundly shape the character of its modernity in a way which will be different from Western modernity. My first point concerns the civilization state. China is not really, really a nation state. It has been for 100 years. It's called itself that. But 100 years in the history of China is nothing. I mean, you know, Qing Dynasty, when China began to acquire, at least in its populous parts, its present borders in the eastern part of China, followed by the Han Dynasty, and you can already see, you know, the line of continuity then from 221 BC to the present. China has the longest continuously existing polity in the world. At least 1,900 years of China's history have been as a civilization state, not as a nation state. So I like to think of China as nation state is the topsoil, and the geological structure of China is that of a civilization state. You see, all the things that give China and the Chinese their sense of identity predate the era of the nation state. I mean, not sort of big things have happened in the last 100 years, but if you go back to the real defining characteristics, the nature of the Chinese family, ideographic language, ancestral worship, typical forms of Chinese guanxi, typical forms of Chinese relationship, special nature and position of the state within society, all these things and many more are products of the civilization state era. This is very different from European nation states, or indeed the United States, which is a peculiar state in the sense that it sort of started, it removed its previous history with European settlement. European identities have been forged overwhelmingly in the context of being nation states. That's how the British think of themselves, that's how the Germans think of themselves, that's how the French think of themselves. The other point, I suppose, to make, apart from a long history, a far history, is also, of course, China's vastness. For some reason, well, maybe not for some reason, partly because it's a communist regime and partly because China has a strong sense of identity in contrast to India, for example. Somehow China is treated as somewhat homogeneous. Oh, this is a big mistake, I think. It's hugely diverse. It's not a huge population. It's a hugely diverse country. Great differences between the provinces, not just between in terms of GDP per head, in terms of income, but also in terms of culture and in terms of socioeconomic structure. And you don't even need to go to the western regions to see this point. So this is another characteristic of China as a civilization state. Well, you might ask me, well, so what? What does it mean? What are its implications? Why is it important? I've got 3 points I'd like to make. Firstly, well, China's equilibrium condition ever since the Qin has been a sense of being a unified civilization. That is the pulse, if you like, of China. That is the dominant political imperative. The equilibrium state of China since the Qin has been a civilization state. In contrast to Europe, which roughly the same time saw the breakup of the Roman Empire and ever since the division of Europe into whatever the territories were at the time, but today into nation states. The opposite political processes. So unity is the dominant political imperative of China. If you want to know why Mao Zedong to this day is so popular in China, more popular than Deng Xiaoping, it was that Mao was responsible for restoring the unity of China and restoring the sovereignty of China and restoring the state to a position of authority and legitimacy within China. Second point, plurality. This is the second implication of being a civilization state. 1997, handover of Hong Kong. Constitutional principle, one country, two systems. Now, actually, all the discussion here and everywhere at the time was, does China mean it? Of course, actually, China did mean it. Did mean it. We should have taken China seriously. And we should have thought about what the intellectual, political, and cultural implications were. Because it was a classical, actually, civilization state solution to the problem of Hong Kong. A nation state would not say one country, two systems. Remember Germany, roughly the same time, fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989? What was the solution to the problem of the relationship between the German Democratic Republic and the Federal Republic? The absorption of the GDR into the Federal Republic. One country, or one nation state, one system. China had a different solution to the problem. And we'll see this again, in relationship to Taiwan, which now you can just perceive the possibilities of some kind of resolution at some point to this long-running issue. Now, Taiwan, I assume, probably at some point will accept Chinese sovereignty. But in return, it will be granted much greater latitude, much greater flexibility than Hong Kong has been granted, including, I suspect, its own voice of some measure in the international space. Or take the issue of economic reform. What could have been more profound than the reforms introduced by Deng Xiaoping in 1978, which have transformed China, and yet they were introduced in a few economic zones? A nation state would not, I would suggest, do that. But a civilization state, because of its scale and diversity, can do such a thing. And has to do such a thing, because it's impossible to run the country simply from Beijing. You cannot run a state as complicated as this simply from Beijing. These kind of centralized notions we have in our head of everything's determined in Beijing and so on is a mistake. And my third point about a civilization state is intimacy with history. History is very important to the Chinese. Not just near history, not just a few centuries history as it is in my country, but far history. Far history. That, and not just the scholars, but the ordinary man and woman in the street can cite lots of examples from the past. Many debates in China today, contemporary debates, are framed and referenced by a debate that took place, you know, many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years ago in China. Now, my starting point here, then, an absolute anchor point in my argument, I think, is that the civilization, that China is fundamentally a civilization state. And, or as a fine American sinologist, Lucien Pai, who died recently, wrote something like, China is a civilization masquerading as a nation state, obliged by its weakness at the end of the 19th century to accept the straitjacket of European norms. Well put. And I think as time goes by, China will become more comfortable about calling itself a civilization state. It hasn't felt comfortable. It hasn't, so far, because of its weakness, because of its poverty, because of its relative impotence, it's not felt it could be what it is. And I think increasingly it will feel that. My second point concerns the tributary state system. And this is a more speculative point. Now, for thousands of years, literally thousands of years, the eastern part of Asia was organized according to the tributary state system. You're probably familiar with it, but just a few points in relationship to it. Firstly, it was overwhelmingly China-centric. China was really the backbone of it, the arbiter of it, and so on. States, kingdoms, and so on paid tribute to the emperor in return for forms of protection. The tribute states accepted the ascendancy and supremacy of Chinese culture. It was quite a flexible system and diverse system, in that different countries enjoyed different tributary relations. For example, Japan had a more distant relationship than Korea. And it proved, as you can see from its longevity, a remarkably stable system. But it broke up at the end of the 19th century with the demise of the Qing, the decline of China, the implosion of China, and the arrival of European colonialism. Now, look what's happening. As you can see, this is what this graph is about, this chart is about, is the reconfiguration of the East Asian economy around China. I'm sorry that the figures are not more recent than 2002, but they're dramatic enough as they are. 12-year period, and you can see that the share of exports from the various countries in the region taken by the Chinese market is increasing with great speed. I mean, the most dramatic example is Taiwan, which is now around 40% of its exports go to China. Or South Korea, always very dramatic. This year, Japan, China overtook the Chinese, overtook the American market for Japanese exports. The average is around about 12%. It's a bit more. It's rather more than that now. What this is about is the reconfiguration of the regional economy around China. And we're still at the very earliest stages of this process. And this process will have big political and cultural implications for the region. In fact, I would say that in reality, the interstate system in East Asia is going to change very profoundly. I mean, there's been a sort of Westphalian European-style system over the last 50 years, well, last 100 years, but with colonization for the first half of that, which replaced the tributary state system. There will be, in my view, evolving, difficult to guess exactly what it's going to be like, will be a new interstate system in reality over the coming century. And I think it will probably bear echoes of the tributary state system. After all, the preconditions that underpinned the tributary state system are returning. China-centric East Asian economy, that is returning. Europe, which broke the tributary state system, disappeared in the 50s and 60s. America, its successor state, very powerful, most powerful country in the region in terms of security and so on for a long time, is on the wane. I mean, it's in decline. Its power's in decline in the region. So I think that we'll see, in some way or other, echoes of the tributary state system in any new interstate system in East Asia. I mean, after all, you know, old habits die hard, old traditions, these things don't really die, they just reappear in new forms, and I would expect them to reappear in new forms. Look at, you know, just as a sidebar to this, look at what's happening to Australia. Now, of course, as you know, Australia was not a tribute state of China, but Australia is becoming deeply entrammelled with the Chinese economy, and there will be all sorts of implications that will flow from this. And just another sidebar, how should we think about China's relationship with Africa? Hitherto, it's been, in the West anyway, you know, it's always the phrase, the word colonialism is never far away from the way the West looks at it. And maybe there are things to learn from the relationship between the West and its colonies in terms of China and Africa. But maybe also we should be looking at the tributary state system as a way of understanding how that relationship might develop. It's too soon yet to be able to be clear about it, because it's really only about a decade old. My third point is Chinese attitudes towards race. 1.3 billion people. 92% of the population think of themselves as Han Chinese. Now, that's an extraordinary thing, because if you look at the other world's most populous countries, in order, India, United States, Indonesia, Brazil, are all manifestly multiracial and regard themselves, and even up to a point celebrate the fact that they are multiracial. The Chinese don't think like that, even though obviously China is a product of countless different races. So why do the Chinese think like this? This seems to me a very important question. The first and most important point is that it's a civilization state point. China's existed within this kind of space, certainly for the Han, for 2,000 years. Therefore, a very long historical process of mixing, of mingling, of melding, of absorption, of assimilation, of conquest, of decimation, in the case of some races. And that has created, over a long period of time, a relatively common sense of identity. And that, of course, is linked very closely, because remember, race is a cultural construct, not a biological concept, even though in China and Japan it's widely believed to be a biological concept. I think this is quite mistaken. It's linked to the fact that Chinese civilization has been extremely successful. It has great periods of efference, the Tang, the Song, the Ming, and so on. And so a great sense of civilizational identity, Chinese civilization identity, which underpins, I think, the strength of the Han Chinese identity. Secondly, this is the most important point. This, in my view, is the most important point. But second point, widespread belief, but not universal in China, as in Japan, in polygenism. That is, that the human race is separately descended in China and Japan, and not commonly descended, as most people believe, from, for example, present state of thinking is a common is from Africa. And therefore, there's a sort of biological reinforcement, if you like. This is a cultural and racial identity here, a cultural and biological sense of identity. And thirdly, but I think the least important, there was rampant racism in China at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, which was part of KMT, Sun Yat-sen, the idea was that China was one race and so on, and Chiang Kai-shek. But I don't think that's as nearly as important. But what are the implications of this? And the implications are extremely important. The implication is that, in my view, the Han Chinese have a very weak conception of cultural difference. You want some evidence? I think the evidence is in relationship to the two most different ethnic minorities in China vis-a-vis the Han, namely the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. And the Han Chinese, it's not just a government question, this is a deep cultural issue. It find it very, very, find it impossible to accept, really, or respect the culture, the religion, the languages that of these peoples. And so, you know, you've got a crisis, perpetual crisis in the relationship between the Uyghurs and the Tibetans. Now, historically, this was resolved, quite frankly, everywhere, more or less, by a process of steady assimilation and population movement. And maybe the same will happen, but maybe it can't now, because China is in the global spotlight in a quite new way. But there's a wider point, isn't there? There's a much wider point. I'm talking about the rise of China to be a global power and ultimately the dominant global power. How will China handle the issue of difference? Because that is what the world is about. Humanity is about difference. And so I think this is a very big question. My fourth and final characteristic is about the Chinese state. Now, everyone always, I don't know why, always talks about democracy first and democracy last and democracy in between and doesn't really talk about anything else. Now, I think democracy is a very important issue. I come from that tradition myself, but it cannot be the only way you look at the state. The Chinese state is constructed in a profoundly different way from Western states. Firstly, as I've discussed already, and I won't reiterate the point, it's the embodiment and guardian of Chinese civilization. Therefore, that is why it enjoys a deference, a reverence, an authority which no Western state enjoys within its own society. Secondly, for 1,000 years, Chinese state has had no serious competitors. In Europe, the United States, the state had to establish its authority in perpetual conflict with different groups, nobility, with the burghers, with the merchants, with business, and in latter day with the labor movement and so on. Look at the United States now. There's a struggle over the legitimacy and right of the state to be a player in the health market, in the provision of health. As a result, no competitors, no boundaries. There are no obvious boundaries to the reach and authority of the Chinese state for 1,000 years. So one of the consequences, which you can see in Hong Kong, but it's certainly true in China, it's true in all Chinese societies more or less, rather than in dealing with the state, rather than the process of negotiation and bargaining and strength, it's done largely by patronage, individual favors, and supplication. And my final point is that the Chinese state is highly sophisticated. Despite the fact that it's a poor society, despite the fact that it's still a developing society, I would suggest that the Chinese state is actually a more competent state probably than any other state in the world, and more competent than Western states. And this is a consequence of China being a very old society, the development of sedentary agriculture from a very early time, and the beginnings of an early state system, and the most advanced thinker of state, of the principles of the state, Confucius, at the time of the Greek philosophers. And so this, and then, you know, through the dynasties, very early development, much earlier than Europe, of great infrastructural competence. Of course, we know the Great Wall, but the Grand Canal, the Great Canal, and so on, all these things. So I think that the state no one ever talks about state competence. At least in the West, they don't. State competence. This is a highly competent state. Now, you might ask me about democracy, or maybe I'll ask you later on, I don't know. But I will say something. Will China become more democratic? Yes, I think it probably will. I would expect so, as it becomes more prosperous, more wealthy. I mean, you know, the fact is that the only serious state that was democratic during the period of takeoff is India. None of the Western countries were. None of the Western countries had the vote, apart from the margins, during the period of their takeoff. So, you know, there's a long historical process we're witnessing here, and it will become more democratic. And in time, I suspect there'll be universal suffrage and a multi-party system. Will it operate like Western democracy? I think not. Because just like Japan, where, in my view, there isn't really popular sovereignty, I mean, there's elections and so on, but popular sovereignty lies with the state. It doesn't lie with the people, in my view. And I think that the same will be true of China, because that reflects actually how China's grown up and what the nature of the Chinese state is. We have to think about these things in a specific way according to the history and culture of countries. Okay, just as my finale. So peering into the future, a more sort of headline-y finish. So what can we envisage? Well, I said earlier on, the Goldman Sachs figures, 2050, Chinese economy twice the size of the American economy. But it'll still be a developing, even then, a developing economy rather than simply a developed economy. Look, in 2050, GDP per head in China will still be a half of the United States. This is a completely novel situation. Hitherto, ever since the onset of the modern era and the British Industrial Revolution, every country that's been a dominant global player has combined two characteristics. One, biggest GDPs. Two, highest GDPs per head. China will not, nor will India. This will be a completely novel situation. But already, despite that, look, top 10 firms in the world, June of 2009, this year, three of the top 10 firms by capitalization are Chinese. Rapid growth of Chinese overseas investment, you know, 10 years or so, 15 years, it'll overtake that of the United States, probably. And look at the dear old IMF, you know. I mean, this was one of the two great institutions of the American International Economic Order post-1945. And you compare its resources with those of China. Now, this has all sorts of implications about what's going to happen to the American Economic Order, but I can't really deal with that now. Think of it like this. For many years in the region, everyone looked to the West, but that's going to change, isn't it? It's already started to change very rapidly with Hong Kong. And I would expect Beijing to replace New York as the new de facto global capital over the next 20 or 30 years. Shanghai to replace New York as the new global financial center. The RMB in time to replace the dollar as the dominant reserve currency, probably alongside other currencies, but it will be the dominant one. And remember, East Asia is already the largest economic region in the world, bigger than North America and bigger than Europe. People seem to think that English will forever be the lingua franca. Well, I don't think it's forever, actually. Of course, we all know that. We should do. And it's a relatively recent phenomenon, actually, and it's been born not by my country, but by the American influence. But I think we'll see the rise of Mandarin. I mean, already Mandarin is spoken by twice as many people as a first or second language compared with English, but of course, vast majority of them live in China. But I think that will change, and we'll see more and more people learning Mandarin, and it become a significant lingua franca, at least in this region. Thirdly, the discourse of global politics has been dominated exclusively, I think, hitherto by Western terms. Westphalian system, independence of the judiciary, and so on. We will need to get familiar with a whole bunch of new terms. Civilization state, tributary state system, one country, two systems, Confucian values, and intertemporal law, the Chinese claim on the South Sea, on the Paracel and the Spratly Islands, is based not on territorial water law, which the ASEAN countries use, which was originally pioneered by the United States after 1945, but on intertemporal law. There will be new historical landmarks. I mean, especially in a place like this, which was a British colony for so long, global history was, by and large, a Western history. The date, you know, what suffused the view, what the furniture of global history were almost all Western landmarks, from British Industrial Revolution, 1789 French Revolution, First World War, Second World War, Renaissance, Reformation, 1917 October Revolution are all essentially Western dates. Well, we better get used to a set of new dates. 221 BC, the Song Dynasty, the Opium Wars, 1911, 1949. I'll give you an example of this phenomenon. This is the voyages of Zheng He, and then here, a couple of boats. Can anyone tell me what the small boat is? Sorry? Yeah, Christopher Columbus's boat. And yet everyone knows about Christopher Columbus, and no one until very recently outside China really knew about Zheng He. And yet Zheng He sailed some 80 years before Christopher Columbus. You know, history, the interpretation of history is about contemporary power, and this is a classic illustration of it. There will be new historical arguments. Let me show you, to finish with, this slide. Could you tell me what they're playing? Any offers?
Golf.
Golf, okay, thank you. This was a Ming silk scroll done by Yu Zhu in 1368. So who invented golf? Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, he's thrown out all kinds of ideas. Martin Jacques never disappoints us. Who would like to ask the first question? Tom?
You know, America has many problems, as we all know. Looking at some of the companies that it's created that are global, though, you know, I think its head of Pepsi now comes from India. Its most famous head of Coke came from Cuba, 3Com Algeria, Intel Hungary. You know, it's actually been much more than a country in that it's included all sorts of other people from everywhere, and that's been very, very important to its ability to accomplish whatever it's accomplished whenever it did it. The description that you gave of China, which is a very China-centric model of development. At what point does the China-centricness of its own model start to fall over itself and impede its own ability to develop more broadly?
That's a good question. I think at the moment we're clearly going through one of the most extraordinary periods of China looking outwards, because that was really the process initiated from 1978. And ever since, China's proved, I think, a rapacious learner in every sense, from the way it's developed its economic institutions to the tremendous appetite of young urban Chinese to learn English. Now, how far that process will go, I don't know. I mean, if you look at, for example, the major buildings in Beijing and Shanghai, including the Birdcage, which is partly designed by a Chinese architect, but also by a Western architect, you can see that the new landmarks of Beijing and Shanghai have a strong foreign input. So I think that part of the Chinese development has been a process of internationalization. Now, I would doubt it would ever be quite like the American process, to be quite honest with you, because America is a strange place in some ways, looking at it historically, but it is an immigrant society. All Americans at some point arrive from somewhere else, apart from the Amerindians, who were decimated and marginalized. So I think that the Chinese model of development in the terms that you raise will be different, will be distinctive.
Over here, please.
Sun Yat-sen was, I think, definitively a Chinese patriot. He was also a Democrat. 98 years ago, he overthrew a system whose historical inertia of authority had been unchallengeable until then. Yeah. He died about 10 years later. Do you think that he had an uphill struggle after 1911? Would the struggle have continued uphill and failed? Or could there have been a complete change in Chinese thinking at that time?
What are you particularly alluding to?
The introduction of plurality in expression and freedom of expression and freedom of voting and change of government.
The problem was that, you know, politically, for a variety of reasons, I mean, he didn't last very long, as you say. After the fall of the Qing, for a period of nearly 40 years, it seemed impossible for any central authority in China to emerge with the kind of a legitimacy which would enable it to be an effective state. So it's very difficult to, in those circumstances, I mean, this period was a failure. But its main achievement was the fall of the Qing. But it wasn't really until Mao and 1949 that certain basic problems could be resolved, which I mentioned earlier, which was unification of China and the restoration of sovereignty, the defeat of the foreign occupiers and the restoration of an effective state, or the creation, actually, in fact, restoration of an effective state by the creation of a metamorphosized state. So, and that then created the, you know, conditions for the development of China, which clearly in that previous period economically had not been possible. So, I mean, I think the democratic moment was a flicker, really, in that period, rather than something stronger than that. Whether that, I mean, to what extent those ideas will resume, I think they probably will. I think they'll be, but I'm not. I don't expect to personally anything. I mean, you know, hostage to fortune, but I don't expect anything imminent in this context, for a variety of reasons. One is because China is still only really not much more than halfway through the process of modernization, with half the people still living in the countryside. So it's very much still in a period of development of economic takeoff. I think that, you know, it's unlike some countries, there's no tradition of popular sovereignty, apart from Sun Yat-sen, really. There's a very, very powerful tradition of state sovereignty, which is much stronger than the tradition of popular sovereignty. So I think that, and the Communist Party has been, for China, remarkably successful. I mean, with, you know, I know that there were absurdities and terrible things happened under Mao, but also some very important things happened under Mao. And since 1978, there's been an extraordinary transformation of living standards. Well, there was actually under Mao, but less dramatic, about half the annual rate of increase that has happened since 1978. And so, you know, this ruling system has transformed China into being on the verge of a modern country. And that will create powerful preconditions for the development of a more democratic political system. And I would expect that to happen over time. But as I said, don't think of it simply in Western terms, because I don't think it will be like the West in that sense. I think democracy, I think everywhere there is a pressure, an imperative with modernization for accountability, for representativity, for a greater voice for the people, for transparency. But the way it gets expressed, and ultimately for the vote and so on, but the way it's expressed varies from one political system to another.
Jake, and then we're going to have time.
Sorry to be hogging these questions to the front table if it's been too ready, but Martin, your figures on your projections rely heavily on figures from Goldman Sachs for the financial and economic projections you make. An American investment bank that has a decided interest in making us believe that the world will grow very strongly forever, so we will make great profits by investing on the stock market through it. Eyeballing these figures suggests that they projected up to 2050 an annual GDP growth average across the world of 3.5% to 5%. And that we're looking at 2050, if you go back over those figures again, GDP in China at 2006 at $50,000 a head, they're projecting, enormous. The size of the world economy, roughly five times, I would guess, could be higher than we have at present. Given even the widest discrepancies between economic growth and energy consumption, we are looking at energy consumption four times present standards. We're looking, I would guess, at about 10 times the carbon dioxide load in the air. We're looking at 3 to 4% increase in world temperatures. We're looking at a rise in sea level that if it doesn't drown us out right now, well, we'd probably have to be swimming to get out of this place. Don't you think, just taking environmental matters alone, that your projections have a little too much of the straight line projections and take no account of black swan events, of other unknown events which we know are almost certain to happen over the next 40 years?
Well, they're not my figures, as you pointed out.
But you rely on them.
But I've used them, and they're not just Goldman Sachs, and they're not just PricewaterhouseCoopers. but you'll find plenty of academic projections which are similar. And you will also find figures from the United Nations and so on along the same lines. Do you want me to answer the question?
How do we get that kind of a load on environmental...
Well, I think that what is certain, and this is what I absolutely agree with you, that you can't straight line the past. Well, actually, these figures don't simply straight line the past because they're built in a declining Chinese growth rate and indeed a declining Indian growth rate, because once the basic shift from the countryside is complete, then, as we've seen in East Asia and we've seen with Japan, growth rates decline. So it's not as simple as that. But what is certain is that events will occur which we cannot predict. And these figures as such will not happen in the way that it's presented. But I think as broad brushstroke figures, they give us an idea of what the historical processes are that we're living through, and a profound shift in the center of gravity of economic power. Maybe it will be rather less than this, but I think this is the kind of picture that we're probably looking at. I agree with you that the environmental question could well make a huge difference to this, but you know, there are many imponderables in relationship to the environmental question, like the speed and the speed of the development of reducing carbon emissions and the development of new technologies. Humanity may be much more successful than we've previously thought of in this context. Okay, I'll give a one-word answer.
If the KMT had defeated the Communist Party in the 1940s, don't you think that China would be a rather more economically prosperous and a freer society today than it is? Do you agree?
If the KMT had won?
Yes.
It might have been a more democratic society. It probably would have been a more racist society, because the KMT had a more racist view than the Chinese Communist Party.
A great short reply, which is a lot of interesting questions. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
We'd like to give our guests something to remember the club by.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you week after next. Thank you.
That was terrific. I don't know if I gave you my first time. That was really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Buy your book.